Goliath is this vast media enterprise.
And it's not just the rich and famous.
This wasn't salacious gossip. We were just normal people who got involved in a horrific incident.
Recent claims go even further. Burglary.
The whole door had been taken off its hinges.
Eavesdropping on people's live phone calls and blagging their private information. As one courtroom battle concludes, other Fleet Street giants face trial. Now accusations of cover-ups against some newspapers.
It is clear to me that we were not told the full truth.
Have reignited this controversy.
The Yard covered it up.
Giving some new drive in their fight for the truth.
I don't think there's anybody else in the world that is better suited to be able to see this through than myself. I'm trying to get justice for everybody.
Can you just describe what it is that you're looking at?
A very young photograph of me from my school days, and the headline saying Harry's taking drugs, smoking dope with pals in the pub.
What goes through your head when you see that now?
I don't even know what to say anymore. Being that young and being under constant surveillance and distrusting everybody around you, it sucks.
It's been a bitter legal battle that finally reached its conclusion last December. Prince Harry's High Court case against Mirror Group newspapers.
Today is a great day for truth as well as accountability.
The judge ruled that phone hacking and unlawful information gathering was habitual and widespread at the Mirror, the Sunday Mirror and the People for more than a decade.
This case is not just about hacking. It is about a systemic practice of unlawful and appalling behaviour.
For both sides, it was the end of a punishing legal process, with one side claiming victory, the other seeking to draw a line under the saga. But it all might not have happened without the persistence and financial firepower of an aggrieved and angry prince. This is the first time Prince Harry has spoken about his win.
Did you feel vindicated?
Yeah, and I did feel vindicated. Phone hacking has been going on for a long time. It's some, especially the defendants, claim for it to be historical. Well, there's a huge amount that has come to light now that people, and the British public especially, simply have no idea about.
The judge ruled that 15 out of 33 articles about his past girlfriends, a conversation with his brother, his deployment to Afghanistan, were all the result of unlawful invasions into his privacy. In total, he's reportedly been awarded hundreds of thousands of pounds in damages.
Can you just spell out to me what kind of criminal tactics Mirror Group newspapers used against you?
Well, there's voicemail interception, blagging of flight records. It was always referred to as just phone hacking, but it's the unlawful information gathering and the use of private investigators that was really the secondary part to this.
When you got the judge's ruling that you had been hacked, what was your reaction?
To go in there and come out and have the judge rule in our favour was obviously huge. But for him to go as far as he did with regard to, this wasn't just the individual people. This went right up to the top. This was lawyers. This was high executives. And to be able to achieve that in a trial, and that's a monumental victory.
Nick Davies is the journalist who exposed the phone hacking scandal.
The judgment that Mr. Justice Fancourt handed down is devastating. He identifies, by name, senior journalists across the Mirror Group titles. He identifies the chief executive of the Mirror Group at that time, the chief legal officer, and he says of all of them, you were on the wrong side of the line here. You knew this was going on. You failed to stop it. It's a really, really devastating judgment.
Prince Harry's settle case against Mirror Group newspapers isn't the only lawsuit on the table. He's playing a pivotal part in two other live cases. First, against Rupert Murdoch's News Group newspapers, the publisher of The Sun. The second, against Associated Newspapers, the publisher of The Daily Mail and The Mail on Sunday. A powerful news group who've been sucked into this storm for the first time. All part of Harry's mission.
This is a David versus Goliath situation. The Davids are the claimants, and the Goliath is this vast media enterprise. I'm trying to get justice for everybody.
To understand these courtroom conflicts, you need to go back 30 years. Britain in the 90s was in the midst of change. Technology altering the way we lived, and celebrity culture had become a national fascination. The tabloid papers held the cards. The power to sway elections, to make or break careers. And as the 90s were drawing to a close, one little girl in Wales was becoming a rising star.
I never look back at old headlines or old stories that were written about me. I think that whole period of my life was so coloured by what the tabloid press were trying to do to us, because they sort of poisoned it in a way.
Charlotte Church launched into the world's media spotlight at just 11 years old.
Will you give us a little burst?
Of course. Just like I get a C off the orchestra.
C off the orchestra? Well, you can try. I haven't been hitting them this evening. There you go. See?
A household name overnight with no idea of what to expect.
It was incredibly exciting. We were a working class family from South Wales, and this sort of stuff just didn't happen to people like us. You know, it was proper fairy tale stuff. I was aware of the press coverage that I was getting, but I had absolutely no context for it. I'd never read anything, any sort of newspaper, or I was reading things like smash hits. but that was about it.
This new global superstar was in demand. But once the angelic child became a teenager...
11 hours and I'm 18.
The tabloid tone shifted.
I'm just going to know exactly where I'm going, little fuckheads.
They're going to follow us.
They cannot follow us. We're going to have to lose him, Mac.
Well, we can try.
From the ages of, like, you know, 15 to 21, essentially, I had an inescapable abuser, the press. They used to cut holes in hedges and stuff where we lived and where my friends lived, so they could use long lenses and we wouldn't necessarily know that they were there. And then, of course, when I was acting like a normal teenager, they sensationalised that to such a point where you would have thought that I was, like, I completely out of control person on hard drugs. And then, you know, have everybody believe that. It's so dehumanising.
Many of the stories went beyond press intrusion. From the age of 16 onwards, she was being hacked by the news of the world.
There were so many articles that stood out to me as being like, there is no way, like where are they listening? There's just a level of paranoia and anxiety. We used to say, God, have they tapped our phones? Have they got microphones in our house?
Charlotte believes an article in the Daily Mail was the result of phone tapping.
There was one story I remember where I was having an argument with my mum and dad on the phone. I was literally by myself. Nobody could have overheard us. And it was a live conversation. It was a live conversation which ended up in the Daily Mail. It's just such a violation. And there were so many stories like that.
The Daily Mail say that Charlotte has never complained about this article, and it was based on an overheard conversation in a public place. They categorically deny unlawful information gathering, as does the journalist who wrote the story. But for the papers looking for a scoop, anyone connected to Charlotte became collateral damage.
My mother was already an incredibly vulnerable woman. Her mental health was really bad. I'd found her after taking an overdose. She was in a really bad way, and that was straight in the press. Straight in the press. No idea again where it came from. I mean, it was horrific. And she's never been able to fully come back from the abuse that she suffered. My parents, they weren't public people. They had never courted it, and they just got absolutely mullered, completely mullered by the tabloid press. Like they were fair game. Like I was fair game. Why was I fair game?
Their motivation could be put down to one factor. Money.
There was this ruthless determination to beat the opposition. You have these big profit-seeking corporations, and they pass down the need to make profit, which gets translated into a need to find stories in order to sell more copies, in order to have more readers. And the criminality in these newspapers is the logical outcome of the constant drive for more and more profit from their bosses.
If you wanted a career in newspapers and you wanted a career in the tabloids, you had to put your head down and do what you were told. And so you saw this kind of escalating screw of anxiety going on, with people trying to find out, well, how do you get the scoops? Where are these stories coming from? And I think that pushed people into using shortcuts.
Even now, few from inside the tabloid world admit to being part of any illegality. Paul McMullen spent 7 years at the News of the World, one of Britain's most popular papers. These days, he runs a pub on the south coast.
What sort of pressure was there to deliver exclusives and stories?
At the News of the World, if you did less than 12 exclusives a year, you got fired.
But sometimes the methods to get those stories were unlawful. Was that justified?
Perfectly, yeah, because what is in the public interest, and I think the public is capable of saying what it's interested in, and the very fact that 5 million people put their hand in their pocket and paid a pound to read it, surely that is public interest enough.
Isn't there a difference between public interest and what interests the public?
No, it's exactly the same. It has to be.
Can you list for me the kinds of unlawful tactics that you took part in?
Yeah, I did loads of illegal things. Stole things. Blagged things. I did blagging. Even that now is illegal. I mean, I'll tell you a great blag on Bob Geldof, if you like, to give you an idea. So Bob, he got off with this girl in France. So we rang up the hotel and said, because I speak French, I said, we are Monsieur Geldof's accountants. Can you send us his bill? So they faxed us over the bill. Everything he'd had on room service, all the numbers he'd called. So we just called through all the numbers and worked out who his new girlfriend was, which I think is a brilliant piece of investigative journalism. But is that illegal?
Yes.
Oh, well, anyway, it probably wasn't in the 90s.
Then there's the act of voicemail interception or phone hacking, a legally grey area until it was made a crime in the year 2000. But Paul tells me it didn't stop the News of the World from doing it on an industrial scale.
Did you hack anyone?
I didn't really have to because, I was senior enough not to have to do it. The people who did it were the reporters who were trying to get on, and they were bullied by the bosses. But they were hacked everyone's phone. I mean, literally everyone's phone. We had a number, we were going to listen to it. It was almost an industry standard technique. Everybody did it all the time. We didn't see it as bad. We didn't see it as illegal. So you could say it's pretty victimless crime. You didn't even know.
But don't people have a right to privacy?
You might want privacy, but you don't need it. The only people who actually need it are people who are doing something fundamentally wrong or bad. And that's why we had all our surveillance techniques to catch them out.
Now it's alleged the tricks of some of the tabloids went far beyond just phone hacking.
There was microphones in window boxes, medical records, all blagged and stolen.
In those days, the paparazzi was something else. I mean, something extraordinary. Doesn't mean it doesn't happen still today, to me, to other people, but, you know, I remember that night out. I remember the paparazzi trying to get in the door, to get in the car. I remember being hit over the head by cameras. I remember my security doing everything they could to try to keep them away. Felt like harassment. It felt horrible then, it feels horrible now.
How do you feel today, Hugh?
I seem to have no privacy at all.
Just look towards me, and then we'll go off. Come on, Amanda.
All right, guys, that's it.
You know, wherever I went, whatever I did, there could well be a photographer or a journalist waiting, watching.
Some say the loss of privacy is simply the price you pay for fame and fortune. But Hugh Grant believes that as his profile grew, so too did the illegal acts used against him.
This isn't something that's only about phone hacking. There was microphones in window boxes outside the house. There were trackers, microphones dropped into my car. There were medical records of me and mothers of my children, for instance. All blagged and stolen out of the NHS. And perhaps most spectacularly, the burglary of both my flat and my office.
The actor recently made these claims in legal action against The Sun, allegations the newspaper has always denied.
Can you take me back to that moment when you discovered you'd been burgled?
So, in the case of my flat burglary, yeah, it was quite spectacular in that the whole door had been taken off its hinges. It's a big walk up, like four floors up. And yes, they'd been through the flat and nothing was stolen. They'd been there to get information. And a lot of information about the interior and the contents of my flat appeared in newspapers a couple of days later. And there's never been a burglary before or since.
But back then, Hugh says, even contacting the police brought its own risks.
These people live above the law. And the police, I'm afraid, at least at that stage, were as dangerous as the reporters. If you called the police about anything, I remember my girlfriend getting mugged just around here. If you called them, you were absolutely sure that the first person who would turn up would not be a policeman, it would be a reporter. Because the Met just got straight on the phone to the tabloids, tipped them off.
Most of the more difficult or illegal acts were farmed out to private investigators, PIs, specialising in what was known as the dark arts. And sometimes they had links to the police. Peter, which isn't his real name, was a serving officer, whilst moonlighting as a PI. He says he worked for Mirror Group and News Group newspapers.
We mainly specialised in the surveillance side of things. Anything from accessing voicemails, getting into people's emails, phone tapping.
If you personally couldn't get hold of information, how did you go about finding it? What did you do?
We had a network of subcontractors who could help us with getting any information that we wanted. Some of them were more prevalent in blagging. Some were good at IT stuff. And some were good at phone tapping.
Do you think that the people who commissioned your work knew that the information could only have come from unlawful methods?
It was a bit like the Wild West, really. It was very open. Everything was talked about. I don't think that there were ever a time where anyone would say, you need to be careful about this.
But away from Fleet Street, their victims and the public had no idea. Until, in 2005, a chain of events at the News of the World exposed their unlawful tactics.
The royal correspondent of the News of the World, Clive Goodman, is plodding away in the News of the World office, not doing terribly well. There's this private investigator in the background, Glenn Mulcair, who's helping other people to hack voicemail. Goodman hooks up with him and says, come on, help me out here, mate. The mistake that Goodman and Mulcair made was to target the one group of people in this country who have more prestige and more power than Rupert Murdoch and his company, the royal family.
They systematically targeted phone numbers from the royal household, and to some extent, they were successful. Their hacking did bring in exclusives about Prince Harry and William, but the details were so specific they could only have come from one place, voicemails. Buckingham Palace grew suspicious and contacted the police.
In August 2006, Clive Goodman and Glenn Mulcair are arrested. The police seize the private investigators' notebooks containing thousands of names and mobile numbers, but no one else at the News of the World is charged. Within months, Scotland Yard closes the police investigation, only giving their reasons years later.
Our inquiries show that in the vast majority of cases, there was insufficient evidence to show that tapping had actually been achieved.
The pair are convicted in January 2007. Though the paper's editor, Andy Coulson, says he had no idea it had been going on, he resigns and moves on to a new job as Director of Communications for the then opposition leader, David Cameron.
I believe in giving people a second chance.
In February, the paper's new editor says an internal investigation found it had been a rogue exception carried out by a single reporter in their newsroom.
And the News of the World succeeded at that time at strapping down a cover-up. They were allowed to get away with claiming, nothing to see here, one dodgy reporter, that's it. And they very, very nearly got away with that.
The police didn't act quickly enough. I was deputy editor of the News of the World before the hacking era. Later on, again before the hacking era, I was deputy editor of the Daily Mirror and editor of the Sunday Mirror. People in the industry weren't buying it, or at least most of them weren't, especially anybody with any tabloid experience.
But the scandal was about to evolve beyond celebrity to those caught up in tragedy, prompting public outrage and years of claims, court cases and compensation.
I was contacted by a complete stranger who was in a position to know the whole truth about the phone hacking saga. And he sent me an email and said, here's my mobile phone number, contact me, but whatever you do, don't leave a voicemail message.
Five years had passed since the arrests at the News of the World. Britain had moved on, and at the tabloid papers, it was business as usual. But then, the story took on a new dimension, centred on Millie Dowler, a teenager who'd been murdered 7 years earlier.
Tonight, it's alleged a private detective working for the News of the World hacked into the missing girl's mobile phone and listened to her messages.
I understood that the targeting of Millie Dowler was the most powerful story we had done so far, and said so to the editor when I filed it. I didn't foresee the extent to which it would make the whole House of Cards collapse.
And people felt completely outraged that a couple of journalists were tampering with a live police inquiry into the murder of a schoolgirl. And this went beyond anything to do with hacking into the phone of a celebrity. This was on another scale. Something had to be done.
Politicians don't want to alienate the press. They never have. But if the public feel that way, then the politicians can't ignore it. And the politicians didn't.
Just days after the story broke, the Prime Minister, David Cameron, announced a two-part public inquiry into the scandal.
These are the questions that need answering. Why did the first police investigation fail so abysmally? What exactly was going on at the News of the World? And what was going on at other newspapers?
That weekend, after 168 years, the News of the World closed for good with this sentimental final front page. But shocking though it was, the hacking of Millie Dowler wasn't a lone example. It's now thought thousands of people who weren't famous were potentially targeted in the same way.
At least four explosions of rock central London in a major coordinated terrorist attack.
Paul Dadge was propelled onto the front pages when he was photographed helping the wounded in the aftermath of the 7/7 London bombings.
It's obviously a memory that's deeply ingrained upon me, more so mentally. But yeah, that picture changed my life. I just wanted to help people on that day. I can just remember hearing the shutters of the cameras growing, click, 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 click. I was now being held up as this heroic poster boy when, in effect, for me, people had died underground, and I found that very difficult to deal with.
For the media, that photo teased a mystery they couldn't wait to reveal.
Do you know if she had been in the blaster train or the one ahead of you?
I don't know that, no. I didn't ask her that.
Do you know which hospital she's in?
Don't know that, no.
Hungry for the next scoop, every journalist wanted to know the identity of the woman behind the mask.
By the time I'd left that concourse, the story had been told to pretty much everybody who was there, and everybody, importantly, had my mobile number, because I just said, there's my mobile, you know, if you need anything else, let me know and I'll help you out as much as I can.
Days after the hacking of Millie Dowler's phone came to light, police contacted Paul to let him know he too had been hacked by the News of the World.
I wasn't surprised, because there was such an enormous pressure on journalists to deliver the story of myself and the person I was pictured with. And I remember at some point I got told by one journalist that she was going to lose her job if she didn't get this story.
He's since received compensation and newsgroup newspapers expressed regret for the distress caused.
We weren't celebrities. This wasn't salacious gossip. We were just normal people who got involved in a horrific incident. When something like that happens, it makes you feel very vulnerable because you've lost control of the story of what you want to tell and what you don't want to tell. And that's very, very hard. It does take its toll on you.
The Leveson inquiry began on the 14th of November 2011. 57 celebrities, politicians and members of the public who were victims of press intrusion gave evidence across its 97 days. One of them, Christopher Jeffries, a retired schoolteacher who found himself in the centre of a media storm during a murder investigation.
I could barely go out. In effect, I'd become a prisoner in my own house.
Christopher had been the landlord of Joanna Yates, a young woman whose body was found in Bristol on Christmas Day in 2010.
I opened the door, at which point I was told I was being arrested on suspicion of the murder of Joe Yates. That is the psychological equivalent, I think, of being given a knockout blow.
He spent 3 days in police custody. By the time he was released without charge, headlines had untruthfully painted him as a snooping, over-sexualised predator, linking him to a convicted paedophile and even a previously unsolved murder.
the picture that was being painted in the tabloids, it was a sensational story, was something they wanted to exploit. It was perfectly clear that in reporting the case as they had, one of the motives of the newspapers was to whip up as much public anger against me as they could.
He was awarded substantial damages and a public apology from 8 newspapers for more than 40 libelous articles. But recently he learnt some papers may have been using unlawful tactics against him and is now bringing a claim against News Group newspapers, owners of The Sun and the News of the World.
Well, the allegation is that I was subjected to all sorts of illegality, but it's further confirmation that there are almost no depths to which certain elements of the media will not stoop.
Whilst the Leveson inquiry gave victims of press intrusion the chance to share their experience, most of the 300 people giving evidence were insiders from the worlds of press, politics and the police.
There is a great deal of official secrecy around what actually goes on in the power elite. And suddenly, there they were, being forced to talk in public. 4 prime ministers, senior civil servants, senior police officers, and the most secretive beasts in the jungle, newspaper editors, hauled out on oath in public. Now tell us what's been going on.
Those at the helm of the News of the World were quick to make denials.
Witness is Mr. Coulson, please.
No, they didn't wield too much power over politicians.
I'm not sure I necessarily buy the theory that a newspaper's endorsement will influence its readers directly in that way.
No, they didn't influence the police.
I felt that the contact I had with police officers, particularly commissioners and senior police officers, was always appropriate.
And above all, no, they didn't know about the industrial-scale hacking that went on inside the paper.
I think the senior executives were all misinformed and shielded from anything that was going on there. Someone took charge of a cover-up, which we were victim to, and I regret.
This inquiry wasn't just about the News of the World.
Good morning, Mr. Brown.
Good morning, sir. Our first witness is Mr. Hipwell.
Thank you.
I, James Hipwell, do solemnly, sincerely and truly declare...
The entire tabloid industry was under scrutiny, but just one journalist was willing to blow the whistle on unlawful behaviour at another paper. James Hipwell was a columnist at the Daily Mirror.
I was sitting next to the showbiz journalists, and I saw phone hacking going on from the middle of 1999. I would say that I saw it happen every day. There were 8 or 10 journalists on the show business desk, and most of them were engaged in phone hacking.
Can you tell me who was your editor at the time, and did he know about what was happening?
My editor was Piers Morgan. He was somewhat obsessive about celebrity news. There was no question that he knew what was going on, because he would ask them, you know, where did this story come from?
And did you get the impression that this was just a technique used by Mirror Group newspapers?
No. I mean, on one occasion, I remember great laughter in the newsroom. And so I asked what was going on. And this journalist he'd hacked into the voicemail of one of the Spice Girls. He knew that one of his opposite numbers on The Sun was going to be hacking the same phone and would have picked up the same message, and he didn't want that journalist to hear the message, so he just deleted it.
The Sun deny this. James lost his job on the City column after he was caught insider trading. Lawyers for the Mirror papers at the Leveson inquiry tried unsuccessfully to discredit him, suggesting these claims were his revenge.
Some might accuse you of having an axe to grind because you lost your job at the Daily Mirror.
That didn't really come into it. I mean, I see the Mirror now as a criminal enterprise. My column was part of that criminal enterprise. I accept that. I know that, you know, we needed to be reined in. And it's not often in your life that you get an opportunity to look back at what's just happened and reflect on it and try to put things right.
But James was a lone voice amidst a clamour of denials from Mirror Group bosses.
I swear by Almighty God that the evidence I shall give...
The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Denials that two High Court judges presiding over civil cases against the papers have since found to be untrue.
Is it true that there was phone hacking going on amongst the show business team?
No, not to my knowledge.
The inaccuracy of this statement has been established.
I have seen no evidence to show me that phone hacking has ever taken place at Chillingtonworth.
Ms. Bailey knew, or turned a blind eye to it, from about the end of 2006.
Are you able to help us again as to whether or not it's true?
I'm afraid I'm not.
I have already found that she was involved in it, and she clearly had knowledge of it.
I have no reason or knowledge to believe it was going on.
But did you see this sort of thing going on, Mr. Morgan?
No.
You sure about that?
100%.
There is compelling evidence that the editors of each newspaper knew very well that voicemail interception was being used extensively and habitually, and that they were happy to take the benefits of it.
I think the police need to investigate this because we could have a situation where a number of important witnesses to a government-backed, British taxpayer-funded inquiry have lied. And that's just simply unacceptable.
Perhaps the most shocking revelation to come out of Prince Harry's court action is that these unlawful tactics continued during the Leveson inquiry.
What is so strange about the fact that they continued committing the crime is that it looks as though they think that they are beyond the law, impunity. But by then they know they're not beyond the law. The risk level is astonishing.
When the 16-month inquiry came to an end in 2012, its key recommendation for a new, tougher industry watchdog was effectively ignored by the papers, with concerns over press freedom.
We do have an independent regulator, but most of the press are not in any way attached to it. And the regulator cannot function if none of the organisations that it is intended to regulate actually join it.
Many say the tabloids under the spotlight had got off lightly, but then a new case brought fresh scrutiny.
And I went paranoid. You know, didn't want to speak to nobody.
Can you describe what's happening there and how
the straight away it comes into my mind, you know. People can take it as much as they want. But the one thing they can't take away from is memories like that. Them times were like the best times in my life. Until I start getting hacked and that.
For years, many thought phone hacking only happened at the News of the World. The publisher paying out compensation to its victims, but each case was settled out of court.
They are not truly sorry, only sorry they got caught.
But then another newspaper group was sucked into the scandal. In 2015, the publisher of The Mirror became the first to face a High Court trial in a civil case. Eight people accused The Mirror of phone hacking. One of them was Paul Gascoigne. In the 90s, Britain was gripped by Gazzomania. Widely regarded as one of the best footballers England has ever produced. Many labelled him a genius.
Oh, here's Gascoigne.
Gascoigne, he can finish it here! Paul Gascoigne! 2-0!
You're coming after it. Go on. In England, it's brilliant becoming famous, but once you're famous, they just try and knock you down as much as they can.
As the 90s came to an end, injuries and excesses had taken their toll on his career. There was divorce and struggles with alcohol.
I finished playing football, started drinking heavy. I was in a bad way, to be fair.
He soon found himself in the crosshairs of the tabloids, whose fascination with his fall from grace led to the repeated hacking of his phone to get stories.
And I went paranoid. So I went out and bought 6 phones. So I just kept on changing numbers. I thought, right, fuck it, I'm getting hacked again. So I'll go and buy another mobile phone and get rid of that one. And then I got so scared to fucking speak to someone. I'd check into a hotel room and use a hotel phone. You know, and you think, God, when's it going to stop? Yeah, and then I come a recluse. You know, didn't want to speak to nobody.
With every story published, his suspicions turned on those around him, even those he was closest to.
I was just speaking to my mum and dad, and just them. The next day, it'd come out in the papers. So I went mad. I said, what the fuck are you speaking to the papers for? I said, we haven't spoken to them. I said, you have. They're the only two I've spoken to. I love my mum and dad. So to think they thought they were hackers was good.
What did headlines like that do to you?
Oh, it's fucking horrific. Then eventually you end up reading the story and thinking, fucking hell, here we go again. I don't trust anybody anymore. I mean, it's sad that, really.
In Paul Gascoigne's case against the Mirror newspapers, his legal team submitted 18 articles about him, published in the early 2000s. The newspaper group admitted all of them were the product of unlawful information gathering. Throughout that time, he'd been struggling with addiction and been treated in rehab.
Do you think that the actions, the illegal actions of the tabloids, exacerbated
definitely.
Your alcohol problems?
I'd ring my therapist and say, listen, I feel like I'm going to have a drink because I know I'm getting hacked. Again, and he just said, no, Paul, you're just paranoid now. And I said, no, listen, I know I'm getting fucking hacked. So I ain't stupid. It's happening again.
Working for a different newspaper, The News of the World, Paul McMullen remembers how Gascoigne was pursued.
Is there anyone that you now regret targeting?
Yes, I do regret targeting Paul Gascoigne because, A, he was a hero of mine. He was actually quite a sensitive soul. I remember one particular evening he drove up to visit his dad in Newcastle. And we turned up, there were like 5 paparazzi sitting outside his dad's house. So he was convinced that his dad or his wife or his kid had rung up the papers to get like 5 grand to tell him where he was. And so he went and stayed in a travel lodge on Christmas Day on his own. And I was like, oh, Gazza, man, it was us. We're just listening to your phone, you know. It's not your dad. It's not your daughter. It's not your... I mean, suspicion's terrible.
How do you feel about that now?
I actually feel terrible, you know. And we kind of destroyed his life. I'm not saying we made him an alcoholic, but sometimes at the screws we went too far.
In May 2015, Paul Gascoigne and the other claimants' case against the Mirror would conclude with emphatic victory. It was the first time a judge had ordered a newspaper group to pay damages. The victims awarded an unprecedented £1.2 million. Gascoigne would also settle separately with The Sun in 2021, without any admission of liability by the paper.
You know, when I've got the fishing rod in my hand, I stop thinking about everything. I just concentrate on the fish. It's only till I put the rod away, and obviously some of the problems come back. That's why I love Miss Football so much, because I think why I was one of the best players in the world, that 90 minutes for me was my freedom. I could do whatever I wanted for that 90 minutes.
It is a common thread that runs throughout. A legacy of paranoia and broken relationships. And none have played out more publicly, perhaps, than those affecting Prince Harry.
Harry's girl to dump him. Seems as though they knew something before I even did.
As well as phone hacking, Mirror Group newspapers commissioned private investigators to blag the flight information, credit card details or phone bills of Prince Harry's then-girlfriend, Chelsea Davy.
What sort of feelings does a headline like that create in you?
I guess in paranoia and fear and worry, concern, distrust around the people around you. Clearly, a headline like that has absolutely no public interest whatsoever. There's a big difference between what interests the public and what is public interest. So, you know, what happens in my private life between myself and then girlfriend is exactly that between us.
Other victims of hacking that I've spoken to have described the paranoia that it creates. Do you identify with that?
I think paranoia it's a very interesting word, because yes, then it could be paranoia. But then when you're vindicated, it proves that you weren't being paranoid. You know, same with my mother. You know, there is evidence to suggest that she was being hacked in the mid-90s, probably one of the first people to be hacked. And yet, still today, the press, the tabloid press, very much enjoy painting her as being paranoid. But she wasn't paranoid. She was absolutely right of what was happening to her. And she's not around today to find out the truth.
Does your mother motivate you in this legal fight?
There's all sorts of things that motivate me.
While it's never been proven in court that Princess Diana was hacked, the past remains raw.
Some will question whether there's an element of payback here too.
No, I know that it is clear now to everybody that the risk of taking on the press and the risk of such retaliation from them by taking these claims forward, it's clearly not in my interest to do that. Look at what has happened in the last 4 years to me, my wife and my family, right? So that was a very hard decision for me to make, which is how bad is it going to get?
Some people would say that you know, you taking on these high profile battles, but that actually attracts more attention onto you.
There is more than enough attention on me and my wife anyway. They pushed me too far. It got to a point where you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. I don't think there's anybody else in the world that is better suited and placed to be able to see this through than myself. It's still dangerous, and all it takes is one lone actor, one person who reads this stuff to act on what they have read. And whether it's a knife or acid, whatever it is, and these are things that are genuine concern for me. It's one of the reasons why I won't bring my wife back to this country.
Both your father and your sister-in-law have been unwell. It's a reminder, I guess, to all of us that life is precious. Mm-hmm. Does it ever just make you think, this is not worth it? Life is just too short for these legal battles.
I don't think the continuation of these legal battles is the sort of... The two things are completely separate. You know, my father and my sister-in-law and me, you know, following through on these legal battles are two completely different things.
The scars run deep, from the personal to the political, with claims unlawful tactics were used to target those at the very heart of power.
I felt such a strong connection. He told me he was a spy. The man who I'd love, he didn't actually exist at all.
This guy's been 3 continents.
I'm dating him right now.
How do you know the person sitting next to you right now isn't a psychopath?
The Other Mrs. Jordan, coming soon to ITV1.
I think the press had enormous power at that time. And I think it's a lesson for all of us that we're in a democracy and it's the people, not the press, that must rule.
In 2007, just as the phone hacking scandal was starting to emerge, Gordon Brown became Prime Minister. At that time, amidst a frenzy of unlawful information gathering, it's claimed no one was safe, not even the inhabitant of Number 10.
There seemed to be no limits to what this group would do. The intention was obviously to embarrass or even to get rid of me. Much of it has only become known to me in the last year or two.
He claims he was targeted by journalists from Rupert Murdoch's newsgroup newspapers.
My bank account was broken into, my building society account was broken into, my gas bill, my electricity bill, my telecommunications bill. I know that they tried to get information from the police computer about me. All these things happened to me during the period I was Chancellor and Prime Minister.
He's been accusing the company since the Leveson inquiry, but they strongly deny all of this. The former Prime Minister believes he was being spied on as the country was facing difficult times.
We still don't know the extent of the surveillance. If, of course, when you're talking about national security, you're talking about, at that time, Afghanistan and Iraq being military exercises, you're talking also about very confidential information about the state of the banking industry during the financial crisis. If any of that we find was being tapped, then that would become a serious national security issue that has to be further investigated.
We can see calls going into the mobile phone of Gordon Brown when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer and Prime Minister. The Murdoch company wants to say, well, these may have been legitimate calls from journalists. Just imagine the picture. You're a journalist there trying to write a story and you think, oh, I need to check a fact. I know. I'll call the Prime Minister. He'll tell me.
While some have been punished over the years, many argue that if senior figures at the tabloids gave the orders, they have, quite frankly, got away with it. There have been multiple police operations.
Once Andy Coulson was a king amongst the press pack.
And in 2013, a dramatic trial, where former editor of the News of the World, Andy Coulson, was convicted. And the editor before him, Rebecca Brooks, was cleared.
I am innocent of the crimes that I was charged with.
But in total, in a story with thousands of victims, just 8 journalists and a single senior news figure have been convicted.
Anyone with a sense of fair play would have to conclude that it's unfair that so few people appear to have been found guilty and paid the price for what was an industry-wide, or at least tabloid-wide, crime.
I don't hold massive grievances against the foot soldiers or these guys who did this stuff. Not against them, but I remain bitter and determined to exact justice on the executives who commissioned this stuff.
Some argue that few faced justice because of a police reluctance to take on those at the helm of the powerful newspapers.
The police, to an extent, the Met in particular, had to be dragged screaming and shouting into investigating. There's a mixture of police incompetence and police coziness with certain newspapers. There was almost a mutual back-scratching relationship.
The relationship between the press and the police was due to be scrutinised in the second part of the Leveson inquiry, but it was dropped by the Conservative government in 2018. Michael, not his real name, is a former undercover police officer. In the late 90s, he infiltrated a private investigation firm to gather evidence about a different crime, but soon learnt about the work the company was doing for some of the tabloids, including the News of the World.
If it earned money, they were doing. They were associated with criminals, corruption, corrupt police officers to a high level. They would actually brag. There was nothing we can't get hold of. We can even get hold of the Queen's medical records. They would mention things about burglaries. I was even asked once if I don't do a burglary for them. And they had tentacles into everything.
Michael spent almost a decade undercover, reporting everything back to his bosses at the Met. But even while Scotland Yard was investigating phone hacking at the News of the World, owned by News International, he says his intelligence was ignored.
What do you think about the fact that nothing happened for so long?
My honest opinion, why they tried to tie it up and sweep under the carpet, was because it involved the Metropolitan Police's reputation. Senior officers were too close to News International. So I think that's what it was. The Yard covered it up.
Perhaps another reason some have not been brought to justice is that potential evidence has quite simply disappeared.
And yes, it's the unlawful information gathering, but the biggest piece to this is the cover-up.
It's been claimed at the height of the scandal, senior figures at Rupert Murdoch's News Group newspapers tried to conceal wrongdoing. It was back in 2010, just a few months before the Met Police launched its biggest operation yet.
The Murdoch company destroyed over 30 million emails. During a period of about 6 months, people were beginning to sue, and Sienna Miller in particular was suing, and her lawyer had sent a letter to the Murdoch company saying, you must preserve evidence. They destroyed all of the emails up to the end of 2004.
News Group newspapers fiercely deny deliberately deleting any evidence and have said the company was carrying out a long-scheduled clear-out of old computer servers.
It's very hard to accept the Murdoch company explanation. I think that because of the timing, at least, we all are allowed to say, are you sure about that? Because it really does look suspicious.
Both the Crown Prosecution Service and the judge in Rebecca Brooks's trial found no evidence of wrongdoing. But Gordon Brown says new information has since come to light.
It is clear to me that we were not told the full truth. This is a cause for a criminal investigation, and I want the Metropolitan Police to reopen their investigations into what happened. The truth is important because we are talking about basic civil liberties.
Until then, those chasing justice must pin their hopes on getting a damning verdict through the civil courts. Prince Harry and others are due to take on The Sun next year. The paper's publisher have so far avoided trial by offering huge settlements without accepting liability, as they did with Hugh Grant.
If you're innocent, why do you shove so much money at someone not to go to court?
He had been determined to take his case all the way to trial, but settled in recent months.
The rules of civil litigation are designed to prevent cases going to court. They want to keep the courts unclogged. And therefore, if you turn down a big settlement, say, I want my day in court, and you go on, and the judge finally, at the end of the trial, says, I find in your favour, Mr. Grant, but I'm giving you this settlement, and if it's one penny less than that settlement that you were offered by the other side earlier, months earlier, you have to pay both sides' costs, which I was advised in this case would be about 10 million quid. And much as I want these things to come to light in a trial, I shied at that fence. 10 million quid, it's too much.
Meanwhile, Prince Harry's case, accusing The Sun of unlawful information gathering, continues.
Are you determined to go all the way to trial, whatever the cost?
That is the plan. If I can get to trial, then they were talking over a decade's worth of evidence, most of which has never, ever been known to the public. That's the goal.
There are accusations flying on both sides. Recently, Prince Harry was asked to explain how some of his own messages were apparently destroyed, a judge ordering him to search for deleted online exchanges with his biographer.
But some will say there have been multiple criminal investigations, there have been convictions, millions of pounds have been paid out in compensation. Some will wonder, why are you still fighting?
Because that evidence needs to come to the surface. And then after that, the police can then make their mind up, because this country and the British public deserve better.
Prince Harry's mission stands in stark contrast to his brother's approach. In 2020, Prince William reportedly settled out of court with newsgroup newspapers for what's been described as a very large sum of money.
To what extent do you think that your determination to fight the tabloids destroyed the relationship with your family?
I think there's, that's certainly a central piece to it. But, you know, they... That's a hard question to answer, because anything I say about my family results in a torrent of abuse from the press. I've made it very clear that this is something that needs to be done. It would be nice if we, you know, did it as a family. I believe that, again, from a service standpoint, and when you're in a public role, that these are the things that we should be doing for the greater good. But, you know, I'm doing this for my reasons.
What do you think of their decision not to fight in the way that you have?
I think everything that's played out has shown people what the truth of the matter is. For me, the mission continues, but it's caused, as you say, part of a rift.
You said in court documents that the Queen, your granny as you call her, supported your claim. What do you think she would think of what you're doing now?
I had many conversations before she passed. This is very much something that she supported. She knew how much this meant to me. I think she's very much up there going, see this through to the end, without question.
And this is far from over for the prince. On the horizon is another civil claim against the publisher of the Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday, accused of hiring private investigators to bug properties, tap landlines, and blag private medical and bank records. It's the first time the newsgroup has been taken to court in this scandal.
The looming case being brought by Prince Harry and others is potentially the most serious of all. The Daily Mail Group have strenuously denied wrongdoing, and none of their journalists have ever been prosecuted. So if, and yet it's a very big if, that one went wrong for the Mail, it would be hugely, hugely embarrassing.
Alongside Prince Harry are six other claimants, including Baroness Doreen Lawrence, whose son, Stephen, was murdered in a racist attack in the 90s. She praised the Daily Mail for supporting her struggle for justice with this famous campaigning front page.
The Mail presented themselves as the champions of the Lawrence family. And if the court finds that there is persuasive evidence that Doreen Lawrence was targeted by unlawful means by the Daily Mail, that would be an act of such grotesque dishonesty and hypocrisy that it would produce, I think, national revulsion.
Good afternoon, Harry. What do you hope to change through this court battle, Harry?
The repercussions of all this are a long way from subsiding. For Prince Harry and others, the fight continues.
When people are damaged, they don't just shut up shop and go away. If people are damaged and they feel they have the possibility of getting some kind of satisfaction, and particularly if they have the resources to do so, they will go on, and they will go on until they get satisfaction.